Man. Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
So 1989, Robert, Disney has a the opposite of October 1st, 1982, in terms of the opening of MGM Studios, Disney MGM Studios. Meanwhile, down the road, a little north on I-4, get off on State Road 435, Kirkman Road. A year later, one of Disney's great rivals, Universal, with the Universal Globe, right? You know, one of that and the Paramount Mountain, I think, or and the Lion for MGM, obviously. Film studio, significant film studio images, opens its studios, Universal Studios Florida, in the Orlando area. And in fact, initially, it felt like they were doing a lot of copying of Disney. Like Disney had made Delta, Eastern first, and then Delta, the official airline. US Air became the official airline of Universal Studios, both in Century City, in Burbank area, Los Angeles area, and here in Florida. And you had them poaching Imagineers. You had them thinking maybe they need to go to another studio, MGM, Paramount, maybe Warner Brothers, who were invested in the Six Flag chain, because they wanted to open this amusement park in Florida, and they needed to kind of get all the Disney rivals together. That didn't materialize, so they go it alone. So it took a little longer than they had hoped, and Disney beat them to the market, right? Disney, as we talked about in the MGM episode, that part of that was the film business and the forward-looking vision of Florida. And Universal actually conceived the idea of building a film studio in Florida around the time Epcot Center opened. But Disney had the infrastructure. Disney had the wherewithal. They had the land. They had all of these advantages, and they got the market first. But still, not always getting to market first means you're going to be the most successful. In business, there is kind of this saying, you need to be first, or you need to be smarter. And as it turns out, Universal was smarter.
And it really didn't look like that was going to be the case at first.
Right, exactly.
Now, Universal, And we talked a little bit about SeaWorld last week, about how Universal has sort of become very much like SeaWorld, in the sense that the Orlando areas become sort of the anchor for the entire amusement park empire, almost to the point that people sort of forget that Universal has been operating as a quasi theme park in California since the late 1960s, with their very large, very successful tram tour that they have there. And unlike at Universal today, the tram tour has stayed relatively the same. They've added to it. It's very much almost an actual theme park, but that kind of got the wheels turning with them, because they were very successful with it. The sort of idea of really showcasing what goes on at the movies and getting to see the stars and getting to really see the productions. It was exciting to a lot of people that came over that were tourists, and they saw the development that was taking place in Orlando. And as early as the early 1980s and late 70s, they were like, why don't we do that at the East Coast? We talked a little bit about the fact that Eisner essentially had their game plan, their blueprint, by the time that he entered Disney. And by the time he had entered Disney in 1983, the idea of a Florida theme park was kind of dead, because they couldn't get the financing. Now, what really kind of kick-started this was a man, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of him, called Steven Spielberg.
And by the way, if you didn't, you hadn't heard of him, we talked about him in the last episode and talking about Jaws, so go ahead.
And two friendships that he had. One was arguably at the time his almost as successful critically, certainly more successful commercially, friend George Lucas, who was kind of becoming a gun for hire for Disney at the time. And another friend that not a lot of people know about, who was actually his college roommate, Peter Alexander, who was an Imagineer at Disney. And both of them sort of were the motivating factor for Steven Spielberg to kind of get on the horn, because he had already had a relationship. He had a very successful production company, Amblin Entertainment, that was sort of kind of the touchstone for Universal, and say, you know, hey, I kind of want to beat George's own game here. And George had been very, very successful with Star Chores and things of that nature. And so he kind of rubbed it in Steven's face a little bit, you know, there's no way you're going to be able to do this. And so Steven had sort of experimented and did what would be the prototypes for the Jaws attraction in Orlando and the King Kong attraction in Orlando. And he did that smaller level of it at the tram tour in California for Universal. Well, he was kind of struggling to make the numbers work and make the logistics work to do these larger themed attractions over at Universal. And he hooked up with Peter Alexander, who said, well, you know, I can make this work. I can do this for you. And so he became one of the critical driving forces, along with Steven Spielberg, for the opening day attractions at Universal. Now, the opening day of Universal has gone down in history as the worst day in theme park history. And just to give you guys an idea of how terrible this was, 10% of those that purchased tickets and entered the front gates that day got a refund. That is staggering. 10%. We're talking, you know, tens of thousands of people got a refund. Absolutely nothing worked. Jaws was supposed to be an opening day attraction. And just like in the movie, they could never get the shark to work. It would always break down. It would always, you know, fracture, or, you know, would pop up at the wrong time. It was an absolute mess. King Kong was another thing. King Kong and Kong Attack is probably one of the most ambitious animatronics ever created in theme park history. And it was an absolute safety nightmare. It almost didn't happen. Both of the budgets ballooned out of control. And at the same time, Back to the Future, which was the third theme attraction that Steven Spielberg was working on based on his movie series that he executive produced, missed the deadline by a year. The systems that they had in place for the ride, just there was no way they were going to make the deadline. So the only one that was actually operational of his ideas was the E.T. ride. As it turns out, the most successful ride that first day was the Hanna-Barbera ride, which I think had wait times of almost 2 hours. Another thing that they realized pretty quickly was that the tram tour was not going to work. One of the reasons why was the only thing that they could manage to get, just like it at Disney Studios was television shows and syndication shows. And as it turned out, most of those operated under a closed set. So the tram tour basically was only good at one thing, driving past what was known as the Boneyards, which was props of famous shows, and basically helping to congest the main thoroughfares of the park.
Correct. And one thing that was successful early on at Universal was the, and this goes back to television, was Nickelodeon Studios, which I think was a great pride for the state of Florida, and in fact employed more people in broadcast and media in the state than any other institution, was the Nickelodeon Studios that were based there. But like all things with movies and entertainment in this state, eventually it closed and was relocated to California, which is an unfortunate thing. I know there's, I don't want to get too political or sound partisan here, but there's this constant theme, oh, we're taking things from California. But in fact, in this specific industry, in this entertainment industry, that the outflow has gone the other way for the last 30 years. So Nickelodeon Studios, day one attraction, June 7th, 1990, was broadcast into people's homes via Nickelodeon, right? Live simulcast. That's why people on the outside didn't know how bad things had gone in the park that day, because they had dressed that up beautifully, the Nickelodeon studio opening day, which was hosted by Mark Summers. So then the next couple of years, you see some changes to the park. You see the resort complex built. You see the idea for a second theme park. You see the idea of trying to get some other films or television shows to occupy the attraction, but it doesn't work. And by, I think, 1995 or 1996, the studio lot tour is closed. And as I said, you know, a lot of the Nickelodeon shows around that time began to move to California, and eventually the whole studio was moved. But when I was my first couple of years of college at the University of Florida in Gainesville, up the road from Orlando, you know, you would always be hearing things on campus about Nickelodeon is doing this show live at Universal. Hey, you know, they could use college kids. They could use people there. It was a big thing throughout the state. And they were broadcasting, I want to say most live Nickelodeon shows were coming straight from Universal Studios in Orlando in that period.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was, you know, it was kind of, because you mentioned Mark Summers, looking back on it now, it was a terrible invasion of privacy for, you know, the stars like Mark Summers, because, you know, there would be tours throughout the waiting rooms. And the green rooms, rather, and the dressing rooms and, you know, the makeup chairs and stuff like that. So, you know, he talks about the fact that he really couldn't talk or have conversations with people because his mic was live the entire time. And that was true with basically every production. Now, one of the interesting things as it pertains to Nickelodeon is the first real shift of the early 90s into the late 90s took place. And you saw a lot of these shows that were very popular, like Hey Dude and Salute Your Shorts. Those of you that are in your 30s and watch Nickelodeon, you know, you know these things, and Clarissa Explains It All, end prematurely because the productions refused to move to Orlando. So that was how important Universal and the investment that they were trying to make in the Florida film industry was the fact that it was more economical for them to just end a costly show, even if it was incredibly popular and run it in syndication, than it was to film outside of Florida. One of the other interesting things, and it turned out to be immensely profitable for Universal, was the fact that they gave Nickelodeon this huge piece of real estate on the theme park absolutely rent-free. All Nickelodeon had to do was give them free advertising. And, you know, I can tell you right now, the advertising was extraordinary. While Disney was really focusing on its characters, Universal was focusing on every single popular film and film star of the era. You know, you look at the advertisements for the park for the first few years. The front page is, you know, King Kong, Jaws, Back to the Future, Beetlejuice.
So Robert, please reinforce this. This is the big takeaway point as to why Disney, who had the advantage, ceded it to Universal. So repeat that. Start with Back to the Future and King Kong, and versus the Disney franchise characters.
Yeah, I mean, why, you know, while you were looking at the Disney promo, which, you know, keep in mind, especially if you were living in the state of Florida, you know, you could contact the Department of Commerce and they'd send you brochures and all that stuff, you know, postage free. The Disney advertisements, it was the kingdom, it was Mickey, Donald, you know, Little Mermaid. Universal, it was, like I said, every single major film series that was relevant to a kid beyond just cartoons. Like I said, Jaws, it was, you know, movie monsters like Frankenstein. It was Back to the Future. It was the Ghostbusters. It was Beetlejuice. It was Jaws. It was, you know, all of these crazy, more mature
films. E.T., if I remember, also.
E.T., Macaulay Culkin was frequently listed. Michael Jackson was listed.
Yep.
You know, all of these things that were, you know, it was the kids post 9-10 years old zeitgeist. And then there was also Nickelodeon and the idea that they were pulling people from the audience to broadcast them across the nation. In, you know, I think at one time they had something like 6 different television shows that were being broadcast. So it was a huge competitor, at least narratively, early on.
And we haven't talked about this. We haven't talked about the Disney Channel and it being really an epic failure, even though they've kept it on for 30 years now, although I think it might be going away. Might be gone by the time a lot of you listen to this podcast. Robert, the Disney Channel was a failure, right? And there was nothing cool about it if you were 11, 12, 13 years old at that time. But you were glued to Nickelodeon at that age.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that was another thing. Like, Universal had gone and partnered with the right television company, and Disney was trying to push all these Disney Channel family kind of centric. It just didn't have the same vibe.
Well, also too, one of the reasons why, and you know, Nickelodeon Disney Channel is a direct reference to what is happening now at these two parks, and that is the fact that Disney was late to the mark and they were greedier.
Yep.
Nickelodeon was part of the basic cable package. You know, your parents were okay with you watching Nickelodeon or, you know, getting cable to get Nickelodeon because they were getting 50 other television programs as well anytime they want. And Nickelodeon, they really rode the crest of cable. Disney really came late to the cable wars, and it was an add-on subscription. And they basically were just too expensive for a lot of different families.
Yeah, and I will tell you, as someone who covers the media industry professionally and has worked in media, Disney has been the single, as a company, has been the single largest, and this is why people now cut the cords in mass. Disney for years was the single biggest lobby that got to Congress against any kind of a la carte cable, right? Because they knew that if you could pick and choose your channels, you'd probably pick things that didn't include the Disney-owned channels, which were ABC, the ESPN channel. Well, ABC is a network, so that's different. But the ESPN channels, the Disney channel, and all of the other things that Disney eventually invested in. They wanted the carriage fees from each cable subscription around the country. So, in fact, they started putting Disney channels on every tier. So if you got the basic cable, okay, you'd get ESPN, which was a Disney channel. You got tier one, you'd get the Disney channel, tier two, I should say. Tier three, you'd get some other Disney-owned channel. Maybe it was like ESPN2 or something. And they did this like so that basically they were late to the cable game, but then they gained it to try and make the most money out of it, which, by the way, the other broadcasters didn't do. And this is another legacy of the Eisner years at Disney. Now, I mean, this is kind of off topic, but so I don't want to get too deep into it. It's probably for a business and finance podcast. But this is why Nickelodeon was, among other reasons, was much cooler for people who grew up when we grew up, Robert. And then that Universal knew that's who you partner with. And I think Nickelodeon versus the Disney Channel is really a great analogy for what happened to these two parks and why Disney, who got to market first, had the advantage, didn't have the disastrous opening day, didn't have to refund 10% of the gate, ended up losing this battle.
Yeah, and ultimately, too, one of the major... and really, you know, we're not trying to dump on Disney. I mean, you know, both of us have great appreciation for Disney of the 1980s and 90s. But you know, frankly, it's an interesting story as far as Florida history is concerned. Modern Florida history is the fact that one of the major criticisms that people have for the Disney theme parks is the fact that they're underdeveloped and there's too many of them. They're spread out. And so you have this parallel journey where Universal took a very long time to build a second gate. You know, I mean, really, they really took their time. And they focused on making Universal as great as it could, but also as contemporary and as ever changing as possible. Whereas Disney focused on nostalgia, legacy characters, and then if you wanted to see something else, they sort of branched off into different gates. And by the time Islands of Adventure came out, it managed to do something that a lot of the other parks for Disney struggled to do and really weren't that successful until probably the mid-2000s. And that was they were able to have a second gate that was totally independent and totally original and divorced from its parent park. And that's very, very hard to do. And Universal was able to do it very quickly.
Yeah, that's a great point, Robert. And that's the point which we will leave it on. So next week, we will be back with you to talk about Disney in the 90s, the Eisner years. We've teased it in every episode to this point. So that's going to be the big one. So we'll be back with you next week.